Welcome to the Consortium Podcast, an academic audio blog of Kepler Education. Kepler is a consortium of independent classical Christian teachers unified by a shared vision for student flourishing. This episode comes from a talk given at the Consortium of Classical Educators in the summer of 2023.
Well, this morning I want to welcome you to our Consortium of Classical Educators and want to thank everyone who's been involved in making this happen. I know there's a lot of moving parts. A lot of work has gone into organizing and hosting and traveling. Many of you have traveled here, and so we're delighted for the opportunity to spend today with you. And there is a lineup of some amazing teachers and speakers today. And I'm really excited to get to hear them myself, for you to get to hear them. And so want you to be charged and ready for that. And this morning, we're gonna begin by doing some heavy lifting. And I wanna get that out of the way immediately this morning so you can enjoy and listen to the speakers who are gonna elaborate on some topics primarily focused on beauty in education. But I want to lay the groundwork for that, and when I say we have to do some heavy lifting, we're going to walk through, or maybe we should say wade through, a few aesthetic or philosophical ideas about aesthetics that come from guys like Kant and Hegel and Tolstoy and Dewey, and we're going to kind of work through some of these to lay some ideas so that you get an idea of the strains or the ideas and the streams of these ideas, where they come from, and the fact that ideas have consequences in how we look at the world, how we look at this idea called beauty or way beauty manifests itself in the arts. And I want to argue this morning that at the heart of the movement for the renewal of classical Christian education is the recovery not only of truth and goodness, we talk a lot about it, but also of beauty and its accomplished wonder. Unfortunately, I'm not going to have time to elaborate on wonder this morning. I had to pare down, I just kept paring things out for two reasons. Number one, a lot of this is very technical, and so it's going to take a little bit of time to unpack, and I don't want to bore you and put you to sleep with all the technical things, but trying to make some difficult ideas understandable that we can take them away and actually use them. And I think it's important in our classical Christian education movement to do some heavy lifting, and I think it's incumbent upon us not simply to inherit something that, or in this recovery, to inherit something that we don't fully understand or at least know how to navigate it. So we'll mention some of these ideas, some of these people, so that you can further explore this, but at least hopefully have some groundwork for some of the other ideas that are going to be talked about today. So we'll get this heavy sort of conversation out of the way at the beginning, this heavy in the sense of it being technological, technical rather, in its treatment. So it's my contention that even though defining beauty to everyone's satisfaction seems to be difficult, if not impossible, there is something universal and undeniable about this idea called beauty. After all, throughout all of history and all people groups and every continent, human beings have expressed the idea that some things are called beautiful. This is not a novel idea. This is something that we all talk about. It doesn't matter where you're at. Somebody understands beauty. Now, for an example, who contemplates the early Christian drawings painted on the walls of the catacombs or the reliefs of that are sculpted on the column of Trajan and fails to wonder at all the connection to such a people to whom he'll never verbally speak or never physically touch? Who views Anton Lysenko's 1773 oil on canvas called Farewell to Hector and Andromache and is not moved by the profundity of such a simple domestic scene of a noble warrior's unwitting family soon to be torn literally to shreds by the horrors of war? And how does one not experience the stately rapture of Bach's orchestral suite number 3 in D major and not feel as if he's transcending his particular human circumstances for just a few moments of incorporeal intubation? Alas, who does not carefully read Keats' Ode to a Grecian Urn and find himself caught up with the otherness of its existence and finish the poem sure of the urn's declaration that beauty is truth, truth, beauty, and this is all you know on earth and all you need to know? even without fully comprehending what he actually means. These are just a few examples of what fine art, or what Francis Schaeffer has called high art, that is painting, sculpture, poetry, classical music. Or likewise, what Roger Scruton has noted, that art moves us because it is beautiful, and it is beautiful in part because it means something. It can be meaningful without being beautiful, but to be beautiful, it must be meaningful. So with this in mind, the aim of my talk is to offer a conceptual basis of beauty that's rooted in truth and goodness, with the belief that any progress made toward that end should be valuable to us. Even if we don't come to the same conclusions in the end, even if we don't walk away with this absolute boundary and definition of what beauty is, I hope we make some progress in having some conceptual understanding of its center. So we're going to walk through a brief but technical history of aesthetics. We'll study the art and beauty and recognize some important deficiencies before we finally make our way to the insights that affirm the universal and undeniable value of beauty. Now, I'm going to assert today that works of fine art move us because they're beautiful. This is going to kind of undergird everything I'm going to say. And they're beautiful, as I mentioned from Scruton, partly because they mean something. They convey to us a perennial human experience in both undeniable and a universal way. And yet they're also beautiful in themselves, for their own sakes. They're pleasant to look at, pleasant to listen to, and pleasant to read. And in some instances, they're so captivating, it's even sometimes difficult to pull our attention away. To steal from Horace on his work on poetry, beauty delights and enlightens us. Of course, some things called art can be meaningful without being beautiful, but something can never be beautiful without also being meaningful. So let's begin with, I mentioned a few names just a few moments ago. We're going to start with Leo Tolstoy. And the reason I'm going to bring about some of these particular authors or thinkers is because in some way they sort of represent certain ideas within the tradition of aesthetics. They represent some larger contours that sort of shape some of these ideas. Tolstoy wrote, "Art is that human activity which consists in one man's consciously conveying to others, by certain external signs, the feeling that he has experienced, and in others being infected by those feelings and also experiencing them." Now, this statement that Tolstoy makes seems to be a noble definition of art. It appears to have all the elements for which artists tend to create. There's human activity, consciousness, external signs, feelings, experience, and others. Tolstoy describes art as a human activity whereby the feelings of one person about a particular experience infects the feelings of other people about that experience. What's more human than experiencing the satisfaction of sharing your most profound feelings about a personal experience in a way that you know there's nothing left to share because it's all been creatively expressed on the canvas or in the composition? To put it in sports terminology, this idea of beauty or this idea of art is like the athlete that leaves it all on the field or leaves it all in the court or leaves it all on the ring. So the artist puts it all out there. These are the feelings, these are the insights, and we're going to put it all out there for others to empathize with and experience. Now, in order to contemplate this idea for a moment, so we have this conception, we're starting with this particular conception that Tolstoy gave us, that art is a way of leaving it all on the canvas, so to speak, or in the composition, so that somebody else can experience the same thing. But in order to sort of work with this, for us to kind of unpack this a little bit and maybe take a look at some of its strengths and deficiencies, we need to understand what art itself is. So let's begin with the definition. When we speak of art, we speak of things like the art of negotiation or the art of juggling, which is something altogether different than studying the liberal arts or practicing the servile arts or critiquing the fine arts. Each of these are entirely different kind of thing, yet they share some significant commonality, and therefore they're rendered arts, only being distinguished in name by their adjective. So our English word art is anglicized transliteration of the Latin ars, meaning skill, enjoying something, combining something, or working it. Now, during the epics that were subsequent to the Athenian philosophers, this is where this ars originally, this idea of techne comes from, Romans picked it up. And so they advanced the idea of techne, or ars, because the sphere of the common pursuits of life into that of artistic and now scientific action. So we extend the use of it from art to science, and each subsequent epoch borrowed from the previous, and yet the Greek lemma maintained its influence on human thought throughout the development of the Western tradition. It communicates, this idea of techne, communicates a variety of ideas such as skills in producing any material form, handicraft, trade, occupation, or employment. And it eventually made its way into our English vernacular in the form of words like technical, technology, and technique. So you can hear that word techne in there. So when we think of art, we can think of all kinds of arts, right? And I mentioned several of these kinds of arts. Said another way, the idea of art was extended to include even more related concepts. And so by the time the Renaissance comes along, art referred to any physical or mental activity so far as it was practically exhibited. It could be a profession, it could be music, poetry, medicine. And further designations eventually created the categories of what we call the liberal or servile arts. So if we are thinking about those arts that liberate someone intellectually, or we think about those arts that we today affectionately call the trades, often called the servile arts, these are the labor jobs. These arts of free men and the arts of slaves of the lower class, as it was described in the ancient world. Now, since these distinctions between the nuanced ideas contained within the meanings of the word arts has been developed in various forms since this classical epoch, it should not come as any surprise that further distinctions are going to be made along the way, particularly when we get to this age of enlightenment, okay? So far, what I hopefully have done is just kind of given you a real brief definition. Techne becomes ars, becomes all kinds of things that are made or crafted by the time we get to the Renaissance. And then from the Renaissance, we come into what we call the Age of Enlightenment, and we're going to make some further distinctions. We're going to make some nuances, and we're also going to come up on a word that is introduced for the very first time in the 1700s called aesthetics, the idea of aesthetics. Now, even though aesthetics are being treated back in the classical and medieval period, it wasn't called that. It's not called that until this period that we're about to talk about. So I'm trying to kind of develop the idea, the way that these things sort of have moved, so we get just a broad contour of it. Now, I don't want to bore you again with endless definitions, but we can say fine arts constitutes the group that are the five greater arts of architecture, sculpture, painting, music, and poetry. And then there's a number of minor or subsidiary arts, which includes dancing and drama, if we go back to the ancient, and these are also universal. So the fine are also sometimes called beautiful arts, and they're among the arts of man which minister not primarily to his necessities or conveniences, but to his love of beauty. Okay, so all of that in short order brings us to this idea that fine arts are a display, are a witness, are a manifestation of this idea, this objective idea that we call beauty. We look at art because it's beautiful, right? We contemplate it, we're attracted to it, we want it because it's beautiful. So now, I brought us all the way up, hopefully here to this early modern period, this early Enlightenment period, and we have a fellow by the name of Immanuel Kant, German thinker, very complicated, sometimes a little bit difficult to fully understand all the things he's getting at. But he's a German thinker and is very technical, right? Now, Kant himself, if you know anything about Kant, he has a very high view or a very high expectation of humanity, right? So he kind of thinks he has this idea called the categorical imperative, and he pretty much thinks that if we are able to reason this way, everybody should, without having to have religion or scripture, everybody should be able to just come to the same universal moral conclusion about what's right and wrong, categorically, right? That's a short order explanation. So let's unpack a little bit of Kant's aesthetic philosophy. In his work, Critique of Judgment, he makes the distinction between art, nature, science, and handicraft. Remember earlier we said that by the time we get to the Roman and medieval period, all of that's combined into one thing, right? We distinguish them by adjectives, but all of them are called arts. Kant says, nah, not so much, all right? So we're going to kind of break them apart and make nuances. Now, in the Age of Enlightenment, humanity needed these clear distinctions to properly discuss the faculties of the mind. And again, I'm trying to not get us too far off here, but going back to a fellow by the name of Descartes, all of a sudden we start thinking about reality in terms of, you know, what can we know? And so this other idea that Kant really develops along with aesthetics is epistemology. As a matter of fact, epistemology is how do we know what we know? How can we know anything? How do you know, right? Remember, what is that movie, The Matrix, right? How do you know that you weren't created, that you didn't just come into existence 10 minutes ago with all of your previous memories already just manifest into your mind, right? How do you know that? Can you prove that that didn't happen, right? So these are the kinds of weird questions that they're thinking about. How do you know what you know? But this is Kant's entire project about aesthetics. His whole discussion about beauty and art is around this idea of what can we know? How can we know what we know? And this is important because for Kant, art is not a product of nature, but the skillful creation of the human will acting freely. In other words, without the burden of accomplishing some necessary business or working as a means of employment. So an artist is not somebody who works. You know, they're not making money or making their living doing their art. They are the ones who have the freedom, the time to contemplate and think about, and this free act of the will create. So art is also not a science in the sense that science is theoretical, and art is a practice. This is for Kant's thinking. Art is not remunerative, in that it's not created for what we can or what it can do, but for its own inherent beauty, even if that means, that the beauty is contained in what it does. So, for example, if you were to paint a watermill, the blades on the mill being, tilted just the right way so that it functioned properly, that would be aesthetic in Kant's view. These technical distinctions show and articulate how it's true, how this representation is true, but it's different than the real watermill. Okay, so for the nature, for the thing that's there, this is different for Kant than science. It's different than the actual created beauty, what we call art. All right, so these thoughts, the reason we're kind of unpacking Kant here a little bit is because it's helpful in articulating the nuances of this growing field of aesthetics. His approach, as I mentioned, is epistemological, not ontological, meaning he wants to know about how do we know things versus what are things. The big word ontological just simply means what is it, right? What is this thing? And epistemological means how do we know it is, or how do we know what we think we know about this thing, all right? So this means for Kant, how one knows what is beautiful is the most important thing to decipher. So unpacking all that, we get to Kant in this early scientific revolution period, this Age of Enlightenment, and Kant says, how do we know what you're calling beautiful is actually beautiful? How do we know that? Now, that immediately ought to raise, a little bit of our thinking, like where's this going? What would this mean for us today? How do we know this thing we call beautiful is really beautiful? So in Kant's view, the fine arts are most closely associated with the feelings of pleasure involving the beauty. And they're more than simply mechanical. They're not merely pleasurable in the sense that they simply they're agreeable to the senses, but they're a cause for contemplation. In other words, the pleasure is not a pleasure that arises out of mere sensation, says Kant, but pleasure of reflection. So for Kant, we know it's beautiful because it brings pleasure to our senses, but not mere pleasure. It's the kind of pleasure that makes you go back and think about it, right? You go back and you can't stop thinking about this, or you can't stop looking at it. You can't stop contemplating what this actually is or what is so beautiful about it. To make it mere sensation for Kant and not to reach the intellect would be bestial, right? So this would be a lower sort of sensation, animalistic. So the pleasure of reflection. Additionally, in Kant's view, the fine arts also have to appear to be like nature. They can't be made with labored effect. So in other words, to put this in terms, if you're going to draw an evergreen tree, it can't be purple, it can't be wider than it is tall, and it can't be bigger than the mountain that it sits on, right? So it actually has to be like the thing that you're representing. Can't have a labored effect. Kant's idea is that fine art will demonstrate a consistency within itself that is natural to its likeness. A consistency within itself that is natural to its likeness. Now, here's why this is important. This is what may be the most significant concept in his aesthetic philosophy. He sees fine art as intrinsically purposive, as that which advances the culture intellectually. Remember I said he had a high view of humanity, of this idea that if people just applied themselves to reason practically and disciplined themselves, they would come to moral conclusions. So for Kant, to view something beautiful, to hear something beautiful, to encounter something beautiful aesthetically, is to contemplate it, and by contemplating it, this raises humanity, the culture, up in society to an intellectual approach to its existence and its body politic, even within how it relates to each other. It uplifts society. It does not tear it down. Maybe one of the best sort of short order descriptions is John Gardner's reflection on Kant's aesthetic in his book On Moral Fiction, and I'll just quote from him. John Gardner says, the traditional view is that true art is moral. It seeks to improve life, not debase it. It seeks to hold off, at least for a while, the twilight of the gods and us. I do not deny that art, like criticism, may legitimately celebrate the trifling. It may joke or mock or while away the time. But trivial art has no meaning or value except in the shadow of the more serious art, the kind of art that beats back the monsters and, if you will, make the world safe for triviality. The art which tends toward destruction, the art of the nihilists, cynics, and merdistas, is not properly art at all. So this is John Gardner's reflection on Kant's aesthetic. Moral art, or beauty, uplifts society. It makes us better people. Beauty cultivates goodness in society. Intellectual approach uplifts, it doesn't degrade, it doesn't tear down. So, even though Kant's helpful in holding a high standard by setting the limits around the idea of fine arts, his view is, after all, incomplete, at least as the final word. Kant applies his categorical imperative to the aesthetics, and in doing so, he places beauty in the subject of the aesthetic experience and not the object. All right, so the subject is the viewer. The object is the thing being viewed. For Kant, beauty exists in the subject, not in the object. So he gets this, you know, like, wow, he's got some things going, it's uplifting society, and then he says, it's here. Well, what are the implications of that? What could be the possible implications if beauty is in, say, the eye of the beholder? Well, then who's to say what's beautiful, right? For Kant, it's easy, because if you were just rational and smart like me and you did it the way I did it, you would come to the same conclusion, and that's the universal answer, right? Doesn't hold up too much in our postmodern world, does it? But this is Kant's idea, and it falls short because it sets back with us. As one might imagine, Kant's expectations are far too high, and ultimately they're unreasonable. Therefore, his aesthetic, after all by itself, falls short of providing a viable conceptual basis for art and beauty. So, there's Kant. Let's move to another fellow by the name of Hegel. I'm not going to unpack everything Hegel said. Hegel gets very complicated. But I want to touch on a couple of things that are just important that Hegel sort of does. Hegel, in essence, romanticizes Kant's idea. Okay, so he provides some promising insights that sort of liberates the fine arts from mere universal subjective human contemplation. Universal, hear this, universal subjective contemplation. Universal meaning all people experience the same thing. It's subjective, it's in us, so we should all come to the same conclusion. And Hegel will say, not really. It is universal, but it's not subjective. Okay? So what Hegel is going to present, he tries to synthesize the subject and the object together. He tries to say, well, it's not completely in the object, but it's sort of in both together. You can't separate the two, right? We're going to try to put them together this way. So he tries to synthesize this by kind of playing on the Platonic ideal, or what he calls absolute beauty. It's a divine spirit on an incarnational journey to reveal itself and give itself expression in art. Again, to try to unpack all of Hegel, Hegel has this idea that this spirit of humanity, of God, this absolute spirit is sort of working itself out, religion, then it moves to art, and eventually will move to the German state, right? That's Hegel's, you know, big idea. This will be the ultimate fulfillment of what Christianity was seeking to do. So he falls short also. So, but even within the arts, the idea has progressed to a fuller expression of itself as it moved within the arts from architecture. In Hegel's idea, it moves from architecture to sculptures to painting to music and finally to poetry. So this is how this absolute spirit is working itself out. And his aesthetic philosophy gives a fuller insight, maybe, to what Percy Shelley meant when he said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world, right? The poets are the ones who are sort of shaping the world that we live in. So thanks to Kant and to Hegel and the Romantics, the world was given a broader, more helpful definitions from which to treat fine arts and its manifestation of the beautiful. And so these two influential views on aesthetics can never be reconciled. They can't be completely synthesized. And so they can be helpful in seeking a higher subjective standard for art in the former and a higher objective standard for it in the latter. But the problem is, because they can't be reconciled, neither of them will provide an absolute objective standard in the sense that there's an absolute truth without any bias as to what is beautiful and what is not. So we can't build a viable conceptual basis for the center of what beauty is or what is fine art. And so on this point, again, like Kant, Hegel fails, all right? So I told you at the beginning, we're gonna do some heavy lifting. Are you still with me? We're looking at Kant, this universal subjective idea, and if you were all like me, you'd come to the same conclusion. Hegel says, no way, Jose. It's actually the sort of combination as the absolute spirit works itself out in the world. It moves through these different disciplines in art, ultimately from religion to art, and then it will kind of realize itself in the German state. And so this is sort of a journey. So he tries to pull the subjective away from Kant in a sort of romanticized ideal of the objective, but again, he falls short. He doesn't give us what we need in a true sense. So they fail to provide any insight into the reasons for some of the modern trends of art, although Hegel does foresee the arts being liberated from religion and becoming entirely secular in his idea of the German state being the full realization of it. But in any case, you know, he's on to something, but he fails. Now, I want to jump ahead just for a moment, because as you can kind of see, this discussion about beauty, is it subjective or is it objective? Where is it realized? How do we see it, right? So these are what these guys are thinking about. And then we jump ahead to the more modern concepts of art. Think of Pablo Picasso's The Three Musicians or Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soup Can. They kind of affirm Hegel's prophecy that they all seem to challenge the traditional concepts of beauty. And with the idea of the special kind of pleasure, modern art implies that there are now new questions that we need to ask, okay? So I gave a couple of examples of some modern art. We could get into some really abstract and some really degraded art. So I just wanted to kind of stick maybe with Picasso, maybe a Cezanne, if you're familiar with that, or maybe some of the Impressionists perhaps, but even Andy Warhol's Campbell's Soup Can. You've seen some of those, you know, kind of stale ideas of modern art. So with these, the modern artists, they're reducing art to the pleasure one receives from creating something, okay? So this is kind of, you know, can we find pleasure? If there's something that Kant says it's pleasurable to the senses, but not merely we want to contemplate it, what about in our modern world? What about in our consumerism? What about in our commercial enterprises? is there a special kind of pleasure that can come out of constructing these things? So, for example, when a craftsman completes the construction of a high-quality chair, certainly there's aesthetic satisfaction in some measure, but can we say this constitutes art? You know, have you ever built something, created something, when you finish it, you feel satisfied? Can we call that art? Is that beauty? Is that experience beauty? Well, John Dewey seems to think so. All right, so this is, we're going to move on to the third kind of a modern person. And again, these are not the only players in this. I selected a few that I think represent some of the big ideas, some of the big boulders that we can kind of jump across the pond and, you know, leap from one to the other. Dewey seems to think so, explaining how art does not lose its aesthetic value simply because you possess some utility. He says this: an angler may eat his catch without thereby losing the aesthetic satisfaction he experienced in casting and playing. It is this degree of completeness of living in the experience of making and perceiving that makes the difference between what is fine or aesthetic in art and what is not. So according to Dewey, it's the experience of casting your pole, you know, playing with the fly on the water, the fish biting it, that experience, that's the fine art. Getting to eat the fish when you're done is just an added bonus, all right? So for Dewey, it's the experiences of life. This, and by the way, this is what Dewey would call the, you know, or we would call a kind of a proletarian or democratic view of what art is. We don't want to keep art in the modern world, we don't want to keep art in this high, lofty, kind of old school ideal, classic ideal. We want to bring it down to the common person. Anything can be art, right? True art, because you enjoyed the experience when you created it, right? Even if you're not good, even if what is displayed isn't in some ways showing expertise in that field, the experience is what makes it good. Now, perhaps there's some room to acknowledge the aesthetic experience within, say, the techne of fishing, but if experience is art, now we have to ask the questions, where's the boundaries there? Is all experience that's complete enough to be called an experience by Dewey? Could we consider all experience as fine art? What about that satisfying meal? What about the, we could run our minds across all kinds of satisfying experiences. Can we call those fine arts? Certainly, we can concede that there's some aesthetic pleasure in watching an experienced angler cast and play or hearing the story of how the big one didn't get away this time. But I would suggest that it's a stretch to call this fine art. Now, let me jump ahead. I'm going to give just a personal experience, and then I'm going to come back to sort of our classical view. And so I've kind of shown you some of the big stones that the idea of beauty in the modern world has taken. But to tell a personal story, I went to an art exhibit. Years ago, we were church planting in Las Vegas. And in Las Vegas, they had this thing called First Friday. A lot of communities do that, but where they had the big art, you know, industry. All the artists put out their displays, or they have different exhibits. And so we went down there to enjoy some of the food and look at some of the art. And we came across one art exhibit that was quite interesting, a postmodern exhibit of art. And it was a creation of numerous familial scenes under glass. So imagine a big snow globe without the snow and the water in it, all right? So it had these plastic sort of snow globe things with all these little plastic toys in them. And each scene was created with these plastic toys and depicted an experience that would be considered typical of the nuclear traditional family, but with a twist. The colorful plastic toys gave each scene a sense of cheap American consumerism. And then the twist was that each happy scene included the gruesome murder of one of the family members. For example, one scene depicted a family barbecue in the backyard, modestly dressed moms placing utensils next to the paper plates on the picnic table, children played ball in the grass next to the tree with a tire swing, and a casually dressed father cooked on the grill. The twist was the eviscerated baby being barbecued on the grill. The horrific scene, right? So as I described that to you, the looks, you know, Okay, a horrific scene, except they were cheap Kish plastic toys, which brought about this sort of reaction of horror and cheapness. And the art, as they called it, the art was in the reaction of the audience. The aesthetic value was supposed to be in the experience of the viewer. It was meant to be a collision of morals, the cheapening and profanation of that which was conventionally considered sacred. The political statement could not have been more clear, and the expected reaction was achieved, but I would suggest fine art was nowhere to be found. Okay? And I would argue, because there's a place to be made for this idea of the grotesque, which is something different. Sometimes I think we confuse that with postmodernism, although there are latent ideas of that. But Ruskin clearly defines noble and ignoble grotesque. So to say something is satirical and it couldn't be fine art, or it couldn't, you know, there's portrayals, say, of Christ's crucifixion that are horrific, but yet done beautifully. And so to say that ugly scenes can't be fine art is a different kind of conversation, right? But what we're talking about here in this sense is placing the idea of the pleasure of art or the beauty in the reaction, right? So you view this and you're like, I don't know what to think. I'm horrified, and yet this is like a cheap toy, like McDonald's little toys or whatever. I don't even know if they still do that, all right? So to remind us of Scruton's insight that I gave you at the very beginning, art moves us because it is beautiful, and it is beautiful in part because it means something. It can be meaningful without being beautiful, but to be beautiful, it must be meaningful. So how are works like the ones I just described, or that of Andres Serrano, or that of Robert Mapplethorpe, for instance, classified as fine art when they not only lack beauty, but are clearly ugly? It might be argued that they're meaningful in the sense that they communicate a message, but here's a question. What if the message is equally as ugly as the work itself? Can we call that fine art? I bring these up because I believe these are real questions in classical Christian education, in our recovery. These are real questions we need to be asking ourselves. As Christians, it's easy for us to say, well, the Bible says, right? But as we are recovering, we need to think about these big ideas, and we need to be thinking about how we talk to our students and our children about these ideas, how we think about them ourselves, so that we actually have a theological and a philosophical grounding for the way we think about a lot of these big ideas. Okay, so let's try to wrap this up. Recall at the very beginning of the talk that earlier I talked about Tolstoy's definition and how it appeared at first glance to communicate a noble definition of art. I'll repeat it. Art is that human activity which consists in one man's consciously conveying to others by certain external signs the feelings he's experienced, and in others being infected by the feelings and also experiencing them. So after we just kind of went through Kant and Hegel and Dewey, does that still seem like a viable definition of art? Nobody wants to give it a shot. Haley says no, 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 good. So now, at first, when I first read that, and often is the case, you first read that and you think, yeah, that's a nice definition of art. But if you begin to kind of unpack and think about the implications of thinking about art in terms of experience in this particular way, maybe there's some truths, that, you know, and implies some particular truths in it, but it certainly has deficiencies, and it certainly has some wrong ideas. So on closer inspection, now that we've traced the modern development of aesthetic philosophy, it falls considerably short, I would argue, of those examples offered at the beginning. This is because Tolstoy's definition of art excludes beauty outright. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to unpack all that Tolstoy says, okay? But this fine author of War and Peace and, you know, some of our famed novels has this idea. If you include beauty in art, all you're doing is promoting the bourgeoisie. All you're doing is taking away good from the common man and riding on the backs of the laborers and the common person, because you cannot create, you cannot develop an aesthetic, you know, judgment or, you know, a vision of ability or your own craft unless you commit yourself full time. And that means you must not be able to work a job. So somebody must be your servant or your slave. So beauty in art is immoral and inhuman. That will be Tolstoy's argument. I could develop all of that. I want to sort of truncate, say that. I can certainly point you to the references and the works that he did that if you're interested in discovering that further. But for the sake of time, Tolstoy boils down all aesthetic concepts of beauty to two fundamental views. One, that beauty is something existing in itself, a manifestation of the absolutely perfect idea, spirit, will, God. The other, that beauty is a certain pleasure we experience which does not have the personal advantage of this aim. In other words, he demonstrates how all theories of beauty either fall into the category of subjective beauty, where beauty is in the eye of the beholder, so to speak, or the category of objective beauty, where beauty is some intangible perfected thing that exists in the object itself. All right, so we talked about that earlier, right? This is where it has to be. And he says, that's the only way you can break it down. Both of these ideas, in Tolstoy's estimation, fall short because both mean that beauty is nothing other than the recognition as good of what has been and is found pleasing by us, by the certain circle of people, he says. In other words, if art must be defined as manifesting beauty, which is another name for the pleasure of certain upper-class people, it's inequitably aristocratic. It's a social construct in Tolstoy's view, because it's not a friend of beauty, or see, he says, I'm not a friend of beauty in the aesthetic sense of the word, because in his estimation, it's a twofold enemy of humanity. It divides the classes, and it puts it on the back of the others. So I won't give you, I prepared here an abbreviated description of it, but for the sake of time, know that with Tolstoy, in a single slide of the pen, he reduces art to meaning any creative work that communicates one's feelings to another without the presence of beauty. Anything that you do that communicates how I feel, anything I do, anything you do that communicates how we feel, and you can capture that feeling. It doesn't have to be beautiful, it can be ugly, it can be anything. That is true art, okay? That, for him, is what art should be. So he's not alone in the proletarian effort to democratize art and rob it of its transcendent beauty. I mentioned John Dewey. He similarly followed this line of thinking when he reduced art to any experience that possessed mere aesthetic pleasure. In layman's terms, art in Dewey's and Tolstoy's estimation, or the modern estimation, is the making of some representative work that makes a presentation of a special experience in an exalted manner. The potential harm implicit in this vein of thought does not exist in the abstract. It's not an idea to be contemplated only in the realm of the muses. Like fire stolen by Prometheus, this low view of art was brought down to man, and ever since, he has been truly on a slippery slope to aesthetic ruin. To put it in Richard Weaver's words, ideas in fact have consequences, and we see the consequences when we just simply look at what constitutes art, mainly in the modern world. All right, so hopefully it's been demonstrated in some measure that the concept of aesthetics has a long and eventful history, starting with Techne, coming into the Enlightenment. But in the philosophy of modern aesthetics, the controversy is in determining if there's such a thing as beauty. And if there is, how should it be defined? Where does it exist? In the object observed, heard, or experienced, or in the subject that is experienced in the art? Also, we need to ask this question. How do we experience beauty? Is it in the senses or in the intellect? And finally, what does it ultimately mean for the future of the arts? What should we as classical Christian educators think about this idea of beauty? What should we think about the arts? Does this play into education? Does it have an effect on society and culture? So to answer these questions, I'm going to conclude by walking this briefly through and investigating the historic transcendent triad. By the way, the transcendence, you hear those called, you know, transcendentals or the transcendent concepts of truth, beauty, and goodness, sometimes substituted for unity. But these are those ideas that are outside of Aristotle's 10 categories, right? So these ideas that don't have particular ontological, you know, ability to grasp them in the way as 10 categories are grasped. So just to recount real quickly, truth is the objective of knowledge, particularly in that which relates to properly functioning human reason and empirical evidence. It's possible to strive for objectivity and truth by distinguishing between objective facts, for which sound argumentation and appeals to evidence can help facilitate agreement, and subjective taste, for which minimal agreement should be expected. For example, some people prefer the color red to green, right? You've heard de gustibus non disputatum est, right? Things that are taste are not to be disputed. However, drivers in the US ought to stop when the traffic light's red, and when the traffic light is green, they should go, right? So you might like red versus green, but when they have meaning, right, an objective meaning, this is the idea of truth. Now, up until very recently, I would still say most reasonable people would argue that there are some things that are just very objectively true, right? We can recognize those, and we don't have to do a lot of empirical investigation to recognize some things are true. Number, right? 1 + 1 is always 2, right? Regardless of some of the ideas that are being propagated. Goodness, in a similar fashion, is the objective of the will, particularly as it relates to human satisfaction. Happiness, we talked about yesterday, being the chief good, is that for which all other goods are desired. One can strive toward objectivity and goodness by distinguishing between what Mortimer Adler calls real and apparent goods. He says real goods are inherent in human nature, and so are all the same for all human beings. Real goods have the universality and the immutability that gives them objectivity. Apparent goods are relative to individual tastes and desires, and they are therefore subjective, right? Some people prefer steak, some people like seafood. This is taste, this is subjective, but all human beings desire satisfying, nutritious food, right? What we call that, you know, may be different, what we categorize that, but in the end, we want satisfying, healthy food. Now, depending on which philosopher or authority we consult, the highest good is happiness, eudaimonia, or of course, as we talked about the Westminster Divines yesterday, the idea of enjoying God and glorifying God and enjoying Him forever. So the highest good is an end in itself, and it's for this good that all other goods are sought. So there's truth, there's goodness. Now, beauty, while it relates to goodness and truth, is a little bit of a different thing. It's in fact a kind of goodness in that it is something to be desired, like the will. Also, it's related to truth in that it is something to be known, yet beauty is still elusive. In a day where extreme skepticism seems to rule, one can plausibly argue an objective orientation for truth and goodness, but arguing an objective center for beauty is not usually as easy. That's why Scruton says that even though you may not be able to explain why exactly, we all want the table, the room, or the website to look right, and look right matters in the way that beauty generally matters. Not by pleasing the eye only, but by conveying meanings and values which have weight for you and which are consciously put on display, okay? So we all, you know, we can talk about beauty when we just look at some of those details that he mentions and we think about it, we all recognize there's something to that, but trying to define the contours of that is not always easy. Again, there's something intangible about beauty, something transcendent that one cannot put his finger on. It's something that everybody recognizes when it's there, but nobody usually knows exactly how to describe it. And again, another quote from Scruton, the status of beauty as an ultimate value is questionable in the way that the status of truth and goodness are not. Adler also makes the same observation when he says that there is less that can be said about beauty with clarity and precision than can be said about truth and goodness. In any case, challenging as it might be, it doesn't preclude a thorough treatment of what can be known and what can be known about this transcendent concept, okay? So while we say and recognize that it's not as easy to define as truth and goodness, it is related to both, and I would posit here in these concluding moments that we can make some progress here. One of the earliest to treat the idea of beauty in the way that has come to define beauty in the Western tradition, of course, is Thomas Aquinas. He's not the first to do it so, but to articulate it in a way. And by the way, we often refer to Aquinas. He doesn't actually treat beauty in any sort of treatise. He doesn't kind of develop it, but he makes reference to it in ways that seem to indicate that they are, you know, implicit. They're presuppositions that we all would understand. So he says that beauty relates to the cognitive faculty. He says beautiful things are those which are pleasing when seen. So beauty consists in due proportion, for the senses delight in things duly proportioned, as in what is after their own kind, because even sense is a sort of reason, just as every cognitive faculty. Now, since knowledge is by assimilation and similarity relates to form, beauty properly belongs to the nature of a formal cause. What does this mean? In its most fundamental essence, Aquinas relates beauty to the sense of sight and to the cognitive faculties, and he posited that the senses, seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting, are themselves a sort of cognitive faculty. He makes a distinction is made between the senses and the cognition that in the lightning epic, but I'll note them here because Aquinas relates one's ability to see form and proportion in an object and reason whether it's pleasing or not, whereas in the Enlightenment aesthetic, this was more separated. In other words, to kind of make that, easier to understand, Aquinas basically says they relate to each other. They go hand in hand, they're not separated. It further appears that Aquinas assumes some measure of universal subjectivity on what will later become Kant's aesthetic formulation. Kant is not just, pulling this out of thin air. He is reflecting on previous thinkers. So Aquinas continues his treatment of the beautiful as a concept as it relates to goodness, saying this: the beautiful is the same as the good, and they differ in aspect only. For since good is what all seek, the notion of good is that which calms the desire. So while the notion of the beautiful is that which calms the desire by being seen or known. So there are certain things we want to know, right? There are certain things that we desire to know, and so humans want to know. Beauty is that kind of thing that our desire to know is calmed or satisfied when we look at it or we experience it or we hear it in music or see it in art. Now, he goes on, and I want to just kind of simplify this so we can move a little quickly. In his expanded definition, the beautiful is related to being seen or known, in the same way goodness is related to desire. They are, in essence, the same thing, but differ only in this one aspect. In the same way all seek good, whether they're real or apparent goods, to satisfy desire, all seek the beautiful to satisfy that desire. What is different is the means of the satisfaction. Satisfaction or pleasure is something all people seek naturally. When it's cold, humans seek the good of shelter or clothing. When someone's hungry or thirsty, you seek the good of food or drink. There are other pleasures people seek as well, like wealth, health, knowledge, and friendship. And when people obtain or possess those things which calm their desires, they are pleased or satisfied. As previously mentioned, the only difference between goodness and beauty in Aquinas' understanding is the means of satisfaction. He explains that the desires for the beautiful is calmed by that which can be seen or known. Again, remember, Kant says it's not just the pleasure only, but that which we contemplate. This comes from Aquinas. In essence, the good is something pleasant to the appetite. Whether real or apparent, the beautiful is something pleasant to apprehend, whether by seeing it or contemplating it. I'll say that last line one more time. The beautiful is something pleasant to apprehend, whether by seeing it or contemplating it. So Aquinas further provides qualifications to his definition of the beautiful. Not everything is beautiful just because it might seem pleasant to look at or to apprehend. He says, for the beautiful includes three conditions: integrity, or what we call perfection, since those things which are impaired are by the very fact ugly; due proportion or harmony; and lastly, brightness or clarity. And these three things he calls the beautiful, which have bright colors. So it's noted that Aquinas presupposes ugliness to establish qualifications for his definition of beauty. Now, that ought to be in some ways informative, the fact that he presupposes ugliness, right? There are certain things that we all recognize, what we would call a priori, meaning you don't have to reason this out, you don't have to think about it, you don't have to necessarily have empirical evidence. You experience it and you're like, that's ugly, right? That there's something repulsive about this thing. And so this aesthetic should also be noted that his treatment of beauty is not an aesthetic treatment in the way that aesthetics have been treated since the Renaissance or Enlightenment. So there's similarities, but he has a different approach here. So he's deriving his definitions effectual of his treatment of the good. Recall, goodness is the object of the will, particularly as it relates to human satisfaction. Okay. So to give just a couple of examples, humans universally desire what is inherent in human nature to desire, right? So there's certain things that we want. We all desire two legs, right? So it's, you know, except for some very strange dysmorphic disorders that are more common today than we've seen in a very long time, most human beings want to be whole. They don't find pleasure in pain, or they find pleasure in being healthy, not in being sick or in being mutilated, right? Aside from these kind of abnormalities, we don't want a malformed face. We don't want an extra appendage, right? And so when we recognize those things happen in nature, but it's not something human beings desire, right? I think of the Princess Bride, right, and the six-finger man. You know, his mom didn't look down and say, "Oh, he's so great. He's got six fingers." You know, they're like, "Oh, what's wrong?" Or you hear, you know, mom, the babies, and look at the baby and like, "Oh, they got all their fingers and toes." And you know, you're checking out and make sure everything's normal, right? Everything is as you would expect. And this is because there's something inherent in humans, right, that we consider some things good, some things bad. And of course, there's different degrees of goodness and badness, but rationally speaking, of the human species, we can confidently say two legs good, one leg bad, right? That wouldn't be, we wouldn't consider it the other way, all right? At least in this aesthetic sense. So what I'm trying to get at here, and sort of unpack some Aquinas in a short order and not get into all the details of the weeds here, is there's a sense in which beauty is subjective if we distinguish between enjoyable beauty and admirable beauty. But what Aquinas has in mind is what Adler calls admirable beauty. Enjoyable beauty is related to taste. One person wants red wine, another like white, another prefers whiskey to beer. These are manifestations of taste in realms of goodness. One person prefers the Van Gogh to the Cezannes, another prefers landscapes to urbans. This is what we call enjoyable beauty, okay? There's objective and subjective. Admirable, enjoyable. These are different ways of talking about the objective and subjective. Admirable beauty is concerned with integrity. Admirable beauty is concerned with harmony of the proportions, and it's concerned with the radiance of the object. This is what Aquinas gives us. So I want to try to answer a few of the questions I mentioned a few moments ago here in these concluding thoughts, okay? Many of Scruton's insights so far have been helpful in developing this viable conceptual basis for beauty. His assertion that art moves us because it's beautiful, and that it's beautiful because it means something, and further, that it can be meaningful without being beautiful, but it can never be beautiful without being meaningful, has guided a lot of what we've been talking about. There's an acknowledgement in such a statement that a trajectory for art is in play, and to get off that trajectory is to lose something valuable. We need to recognize that ideas have consequences, that there are strains of thoughts that have brought these about. Beauty is a powerful force in shaping the culture of humanity, and as Scruton again rightly observes, beauty is a real and universal value, one anchored in our rational nature, and the sense of beauty has an indispensable part to play in shaping the human world. In a democratic society, aristocratic convictions are blasphemous to the demos, because democratic culture seeks the lowest common denominator and tears down anyone and anything that dares to raise its head above the status quo. But that's exactly the risk that we have to take in the classical Christian world if we're going to save art from the double ditches of profanation on one side and kish on the other. The two things that are necessary, and neither of them are going to be easy, both are going to take, they're going to be like taking a fat person to the gym or a heathen to the church, all right? So as we're thinking about being educators, thinking about this idea of beauty, we have some big work to do. Maybe a better analogy is it's like trying to send the philosopher back down into Plato's cave. In any case, the first thing that we need to do is recognize that there are experts in art, okay? So I said all that to say this, because I'm about to say something that is going to offend, okay? There are experts. There are people who know what they're talking about, right? And in our culture that wants to say, you know, well, what makes you, high and mighty? What makes you the final judge, right? That's sort of the democratic impulse. But we need to recognize that it's possible to make progress in developing a higher standard of objective judgment. Seldom is there a pushback when the architect explains to the new contractor who's building a house why the foundation has to be laid a certain way, right? Sometimes there's pushback when an Olympic judge offers a less than desirable score, but not too often. Most frequently, as you'll note, it'll be the umpire or the referee who receives the biggest pushback from coaches and fans at a sporting event. You see any similarities there in the degradation? In each case, it's acknowledged that there's gradations in prerequisites, gradations in the expertise of the experts, gradations in the expertise of the non-experts, and gradations in the accuracy of the analysis and perspective of the experts and the non-experts, right? So look at all of those contingencies. In the case of the architect, there's physics involved and building codes. So hopefully they're based on universal empirical truth and that's related to physics. These analyses and criteria are less forgiving than the analyses and criteria for the Olympic judges, and these are still less forgiving than those of non-Olympic sporting events. So we have to recognize that some things have more gravitas than other things. Some things are more democratically focused in the way that I was using the democratic impulse. In other words, even though there's objective standards in each of these scenarios, there's room for error and disagreement among experts. And also, one might imagine there's more room for error and disagreement in the sporting event than there is in the construction project because of the nature of the variables in each of these examples. So it's unnecessary to keep on belaboring this point, but what this means is there's a lot of room for disagreement and for mistakes to be made, even when considering things by a standard of objectivity. While this is true and universally acknowledged, it should not go unnoticed that it's also universally acknowledged that there are always experts in any respective field. These are not experts by accident. They're experts by means of demonstrable knowledge and personal experience in a given field. It's the task of the expert to exercise his or her knowledge and the experience to make an objective analysis of the situation within a prerequisite set of rules and criteria. This is fundamental, and it should be universally accepted. And it's just as true for art and beauty. It's just as true for music and architecture. The goal and purpose of the art expert is to critique the art's approximation to the objective reality using experienced reason and the prerequisite rules and criteria, namely those that we mentioned from Aquinas, integrity, proportion, and clarity. The second thing I'll mention is there must be a personal reacquaintance made with the gospel. I believe this is foundational for us to understand beauty. There must be a personal reacquaintance made with the gospel as well as an attempt to educate ourselves in the implication the gospel makes about art. In the first place, there's a sense in which the Christian life itself is a work, is the workmanship of God, right? It's a work of art. Paul wrote to the Ephesians church that they were given, or that they were God's poema, God's workmanship, his magnum opus, his masterpiece. He says, "For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." The Greek word means to create or make something, and it shares a root with our word poetry. From a gospel perspective, those who are in Christ have not only been created in the image of God, even the fallen nature is being redeemed for God's glorious purpose. And this purpose is not to huddle and cuddle and speak in religious tones to one another. Neither is it the purpose to wave around a proverbial ticket to heaven where the redeemed will be happy one day in the future. The purpose is to be human and to glorify God by enjoying him now and forever in the fullness of our humanity. And it's in this context that art can really be meaningful and beautiful. The gospel gives truth, goodness, and beauty a meaningful and objective center. Even taste has a moral element, that we called enjoyable beauty, right? As Scruton explains, the standard of taste is fixed by the virtues of his or her knowledge of the Creator himself. And he or she will grow in taste as well as objective judgment. Also, because of the gospel, there's a real sense in which the Christian life is the most viable conceptual basis for art and beauty. Let me say that again. Because of the gospel, there's a real sense in which the Christian life is the most viable conceptual basis for art and beauty. In other words, gospel Christianity does not stifle, sanitize, or prudify art. In fact, it liberates art to be what it's supposed to be. One can say, in a meaningful way, that the gospel redeems art, not of course in the way it redeems humans for sure, but in a meaningful way nonetheless. With the gospel as the conceptual basis for art and beauty, art can be art for art's sake. With the gospel as a center. It doesn't work outside of the gospel, say in Oscar Wilde's context, right? But in the gospel context, art can be simply enjoyed for no other reason than that art is meaningful and beautiful and it brings pleasure. This is because God created mankind to create, and as a creative enterprise by those created to create, art glorifies God. Further, with the gospel as the conceptual basis for art and beauty, art can be an opportunity to express a worldview, an idea, feeling, or truth without being propaganda. Recall Horace, who said that art delights and enlightens us. This does not mean art is reduced to creating religious symbols, scenes, or tracts. That would be likely to be kish anyway. It means that because of the gospel, artists can see the world as it really is, tell stories, paint pictures, and create music that tells the truth. And I'll conclude with this example. Thomas Kincaid was known as the painter of light, but I would suggest that Kincaid's art was a lie. There were not any dragons threatening his villages. In real life, there are dragons, as Chesterton reminded us. Furthermore, we find out his life also was a lie. It was full of darkness, and his worldview came out in his paintings. Not in the form of dark scenes, obviously, but in the form of a lie. The gospel frees artists to tell the truth about the world they live in, to write love songs and paint dragons. This is what Aquinas means when he talks about the sin of man and the sin of the artist. And they're two separate things for Aquinas. Art is universally beautiful because it is objectively admirable. It can be subjectively beautiful because taste allows for individuals to enjoy different kinds of real or apparent goods, and a person's tastes need to be cultivated morally and experientially to be an expert in admirable beauty, similarly as a person's taste for enjoyable beauty will also have, to some degree, a moral and experiential dynamic to it as well. It too can be cultivated. Scruton posits works of art stand as the eternal receptacles of intensely intended images. In other words, high art, admirable art, or fine art, however it's designated, is pregnant with meaning about the realm of the forms, about the divine, about God, and it is beautiful. Thank you.